Hey, welcome to the Runaways podcast. My name is Cody, and today we're going to be talking about, well, ProQuest Season Week 2, because that just happened, but also we're going to talk about sideboarding. So common mistakes, kind of how we approach sideboarding, things that people are maybe not taking advantage of for sideboarding. And to talk about that, we are here with Connor and Dan. Dan, we were at the same ProQuest for the most part this past weekend, so I'll get to you in a second, but Connor, how was your week gone? How were your ProQuests this week?
It was good. I played Azalea at my local ProQuest. I was able to take it down. Nice. Azalea feels great. That list of Brody, I don't know if you guys know this, but Brody Spurlock is a good deck builder. I really like the Azalea list he put out. Feels super smooth. I think I played a one Remembrance, which I think really helps against Victor and all the fatigue decks. But otherwise, it was typical Azalea, just doing her thing. And that was a good time. I had a good time with her.
How many Victors did you play against?
One. I played against one in the first round of top eight. I got to do the sickest turn. So I got to go Rain Razors, fire a Bolt and Shot for 9. He blocks 9. I play second Rain Razors to get the on hit. I put in Endless Arrow. I fire Endless Arrow for 8. Snap it, bracers it in, and then fire it for 9. So it was like 28 damage, and then I still had an arsenal or whatever. I was like, oh, we're not fatiguing this game. We're in a good spot.
That's gross. Because it feels like quite often you don't fatigue in that match. They just, throw a big thing at you that disrupts you and you can't block, and then you cry. But I guess if you push that much damage through, you're probably fine, right? Mm-hmm.
I think there's Spectre of Fatigue, because it's like the Azalea player goes in kind of knowing fatigue can happen, and they're like, I got to set up big turns. Mm-hmm. I need to make sure I don't fatigue and just like really get my damage through on dominate stuff. And it's like, no, just throw numbers at them so that way they can't throw disruption back at you. And then eventually you'll just have like 3 to 4 big pop-off turns, and you'll be in a good spot.
Did they play the right hammer?
Yes. Miller's Grindstone?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Nice.
Is that your only
ProQuest? Dude, everyone's playing this Azalea deck, though. It's like half the field now.
That is true. Was that your only ProQuest, Connor?
Yeah.
So one and done. You just had one ProQuest, go in, win it, go home, take the rest of the week off?
No, the week before I got smashed by
That's last week. We're talking about this week.
This week, though. This week, yeah. easy living. It was nice.
I wouldn't know what that's like.
How about you
guys? Yeah. Dan, I'll let you go.
Okay.
How was your weekend?
So Saturday I went to Unison Games. It's a shop in Connecticut. It's like a 2-hour drive. I hadn't been there since the chain meta, because we used to have to like travel that far for our qualifiers. There's just so many stores now. Nothing too notable in Swiss. I went 5-0, swinging hatchets again. It's pretty normal. I blocked a lot. Like, had like 3 fatigue matchups, I think. It was like 2 Azaleas and a dash IO. I want to shout out Nick, though, who was playing Dash IO. He's a local, and he like exclusively plays his homebrews, and he's been crushing with Dash IO this season. He's topped like every event he's played too. Just a quick shout out there. 5-0. One cool thing about the shop is it's a board game cafe. So they have they make coffee and tea and have donuts and that kind of thing. But they do like, it's $5 for all the coffee and tea you want for the day. This is one of the few events where I didn't feel sleepy at any point, because I drank tea the entire day and night, and it was great. I go into top 8. I play against KO I played in Swiss. Quick minor apology. I might have been a little salty after that game, but it was a good game regardless. I died pretty good to scabs. Everything was fine. We had like 1 or 2 normal turns, and then 5 card blood rush, roll scabs, hits a 4. 5 card blood rush, roll scabs, hits a 4. And then he had just the most, depending on your perspective, either the most beautiful, perfect draw sequence or the most tilting draw sequence I've ever seen in this game. Where it was just like perfectly efficient hands for the next like 8 rounds, and I just got buried. It was either like 3 attack turn, or it was 2 attack turn plus agility, and it just kept going back and forth. It's like, come on, please, just let me just let me attack once or do something. So that was pretty tragic. That's kind of been the story of my ProQuest. Doing great in Swiss. Top 8 has been like 50%. Either I like make a sideboard mistake and lose because of that, or I just get like completely steamrolled. But we'll get it done. Then Sunday, I went to Retro Lotus in New Jersey. Cody was there. They're a newer store to Flesh and Blood. They've been gone for a few months, I think. But they had a stream with commentary. You can watch it on their Twitch channel. I think it's Retro Lotus TCGs on Twitch. I play, I think, round two in Swiss. You can see me on there. I play against Levia. Nice little brood on brood action. And I draw the nuts in that game. It's just like perfect hand, perfect hand, perfect hand. And then I'm on there again in top four, which I'll get to later. But I played KO. I was getting a little down on my hatchets. It felt like Dory was like, I'd say Dory is probably the best Swiss deck or close to it. It's just like very easy to play, very consistent, high value. But I just kept seeing a lot of issues in top eights. So I was like, can't beat the KO, so I'll join them. KO served me great. I lost one game to a Tekla Vossen. I basically had, I couldn't find a Blood Rush, and they had their full Evo suite just waiting for the suit. And I finally got to a Blood Rush, and it drew into two reds. So I had to Blood Rush again, and it drew into two reds, and I attacked once, and then they built the suit, and I read the card. I read the things that went under the card. I was like, I cannot win this game. So I lost that one, but I won the rest. KO was very kind to me. The draws you get with that deck are just so absurd, and it's like very consistent, like way more consistent than I think a lot of people give credit, which I've heard a lot, but experiencing it is a little different. I rolled, only had to roll scabs in like, it was six rounds, maybe in two of my Swiss games I had to roll scabs, two or three. Never rolled a one. I had pretty good scabs variance. Yeah, that event was just super fun. Like, we had basically the entire New Jersey scene out there. It was cool to hang out with everyone and compete with everyone. I made top eight again. I was the two seed. Top eight game went fine. It was against an Azalea. Kind of the typical game plan there is you get one turn usually to like push damage, and then you block two cards, you attack for eight, you block two cards, you attack for eight. And it was just enough. Top four, you can see that game on stream. I do not recommend it, but if you want to see me play poorly, go for it. I lost to Justin in top four. Shout out to Justin as well. He grinds pretty hard. He's been doing well. I think this is his second, like, call it pro quest win. I think he split with Dalton at the first one we played, but he's been doing great. I don't play Flesh and Blood so good after 10 p.m. This event started at 1. My top four game was at like 10:30 p.m. and I just couldn't see board states, so I like took a CNC pummel to the face when I was playing Crown of Providence for the sole purpose of locking CNC. Either way, I think that was like, that game was the worst draw sequence I had on the day. It was like perfectly playable, but every hand was like slightly inefficient, and I just didn't have the like mental capability to navigate it. I think it should have been a pretty tight game. I think my draw sequence makes it hard either way. But I made some crucial mistakes, and Justin did a great job punishing me for it. So congrats to him. I think he won the event based on the pictures I saw on Facebook or Twitter. He did win. Okay. Yeah. So congrats to him. He did a good job on that one. I'm surprised he beat the Tekla. I'm curious how that went down. But he played a Tekla Vossen in the finals. The two last undefeateds at the event were both Tekla Vossen, and they were buddies. So that was cool to see too. But yeah, that was my weekend. I had a great time despite just really struggling to get this win. I've topped every event. I think I've dropped like one game max in each Swiss, but can't quite convert in the top cut.
Yeah, even with all that heartbreak, still a much better weekend than myself. My update will be very short. I went to Fourth Wall Comics on Saturday, and for some reason, this event started at 2 p.m. I don't know why stores are starting ProQuest this late. I really wish they would not. It means the event is going to go until like 10 or 11 at night if you're in Top Cut. And I already had to drive an hour and a half to get there. So I just decided that I was either going to play a deck that won the whole tournament, because that's the only way it's worth it, or I was going to play a deck that lost in Swiss right away and I could go home. Because I had no interest in playing Hatchets and going like my semi-guaranteed top eight and then like lose in top four and get no additional prizing because there's no additional prizing, and then like drive home at 10 p.m. and waste the whole day. So I ended up playing Prism. I felt very confident, like, and comfortable on the deck. I go there. My first round, I'm playing against your brother, and he's playing KO. And normal KO game plan is just, you know, eventually set up the combo. I have gambler's gloves. Hope they don't roll two on scabs. Sometimes if they do, you can still win. But I went through the combo. Unfortunately, I had to combo off early because I didn't have arc light. But it was fine. I ended up setting up a big board and holding off later in the game. I have my entire board set up with, you know, finally have an arc light in hand. I'm ready to combo off. And he rolls a scabs and he rolls a four. And I say, okay, this is why we have gambler's glove. I say, I'm going to use gambler's glove. And he says, okay. And he picks up the die and he rolls it and it's a six. And then he uses all three action points. And basically it pushes me so low that I can never play the game ever again. He like leaves most of my board up, but I just can never hold a hand ever again because he was able to use all three action points. So it's over. And then I go, okay, well, there's my KO match for the day. It's fine. Next round, I sit down. He gets another KO. I think there was like maybe four KO in the room. So I play another KO and I set up the full lock this time with arc light, everything ready to go. So like I have Merciful, I have Genesis, I have Erudition, I have Passing Mirage. I have like all the things you can ever imagine. And then he rolls scabs and he rolls a five and I go, okay, I have gambler's gloves for this reason. I activate gambler's gloves and he goes, okay, picks up the die. He rolls it and he also hits a six and then uses all three action points. And then immediately goes, I've never used all three action points off of a six before. And I am again in a situation where my health is so low that I can't play the game anymore. I can't hold hands. I have to hope that he stumbles and he just has agility for the rest of the game. And I can't really squeak it out, even with like Genesis and stuff on the board. And so I just O2 drop and go home. So it, I guess it served its purpose. I got home at about 5 p.m. and it was and I had the rest of my day. The next day I decide I'm not going to run Prism back. Let's play Levia. I do like Levia, and there was a new build that Ethan came out with that I liked, and so I decided to play that. So I went to Retro Lotus as well. I sit down. I play against a Bravo who is playing Aura, and it's a pretty easy matchup for Levia. The next round I play against a Teklavossen, and unfortunately his flip is in like the perfect location. So that matchup is basically just like if they get their singularity in the middle or at the beginning of the game and they have to pitch stack it, you have like infinite time and then you can just win the game. But he happened to get it like right before second cycle. So it was like the perfect time, plays it, and I just lose the game on the spot. I also probably made some mistakes because I'm not super comfortable with the Tekla matchup, you know, with Levia. So I can chalk it up to myself. And then the next game I'm playing is Victor and he just rolls me. Not even close. It was Young who was, you know, local to the area, but he's just like two turns in a row. He's just like, test, draw card, go to his turn, rouse, command and conquer. Like next turn, test, draw card. I lost every single one of the flips, the clashes, even though I'm Levia. And then he just goes, and he has like D-reacts and he has sigils and it's just like, just rolls me. So I am 1-2 at that point. So I drop and go home. So that was basically my whole weekend. I don't think I've ever like dropped two tournaments that quickly before. But yeah, that was that's my pro quest. So now I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to play this weekend for the two that I'm going to. But yeah, it was not a great weekend for myself.
That Scabskin's Leather is quite a fair and balanced card, huh? A lot of fun gameplay there.
Yeah, I mean,
that was my takeaway playing KO too.
It was so bad.
It's just like some of my draw sequences are already so nuts. And as soon as I run out of steam, because they have to block, because I'm just like running them over. It's like, oh, I can just roll scabs here. Like I'm up 15 health, whatever. If I roll a one, who cares? If I roll a four, the game's over.
Yeah.
And like I was learning the deck. It was my first tournament on it. And like sometimes you make mistakes and it's like, oh, hey, I need to get some value back. Let me roll scabs instead of using a whole card for agility.
Yeah, the sad part was a couple of those rolls, if they just had two action points, there's like still a chance I could win the game.
Yeah.
But it was like, if they roll one action point, I win the game automatically. If they roll zero action points, I obviously win the game automatically. If they roll two again, okay, I could probably get out of this, but I should use my gambler's gloves here. And then both times, it's like, no, three action points, and they could use all three. And I'm just like, no, this is like unplayable. And so I just got jealous of the rest of the team playing Prism, winning their events. They're like, Prism's so good. And I was like, I, not when you roll your opponent to sixes, but speaking of people who rolled the sixes, our meta breakdown from this week got released on Winning Decks, and the number one winning deck is a Skapskins deck. Who would have thought? And it is KO with 15 wins. I don't think that surprised anyone. However, the next couple of stats, maybe not so good for game. We have Azalea coming in with 14 wins. And I think we have an episode talking about the Azalea problem. And it is...
I think it was huge adoption, too, like we said, because of... Thanks to Brody.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, they don't have to play the Draw My Match anymore, which wasn't necessarily unfavored, but it was very difficult to play properly. So Draw My dropping away really lets the Azaleas run a lot more wild than they have been, and you kind of don't want to have to play against Azalea all day. And someone is part of this number. Connor is evil Connor over here with the Azalea. Yep. And then we have the outrage from all the community, which is Prism getting 13 wins, which I don't think is super unexpected, but I don't think this deck is nearly as good as people think it is. I think it's good if people don't know how to play against it. It's also good if there's not as many KOs. I think if Victor, for instance, just starts putting time skippers and two hammers in their deck, they just like win every one of those games. It's just like no one's adjusting, and I don't think people are getting proper reps into how to play against Prism, but it's not nearly.
It feels like old Prism again, right? It's like the same thing. You need to know the matchup and lead the charge in your deck if you need to, right? Like whatever you got to do.
Yeah. I think it's more like a lot of decks could just like get away with running time skippers, or they don't need anything else. They just got to like not let First Herald hit. Make sure you clear every aura, no matter how much damage you have to push into it to clear it. Like,
don't just try to pop when they can at instant speed deny your pop.
Yep. And then like popping is for after their helmet is gone, right? Like that's when you want to be popping. And then, you could fatigue Prism. Like I played against Prism today. I decimated Great Axe Dory and won the game. Just like, it's fine. It's not a big deal. I think obviously a really good Prism is harder to play against. But even with that said, if you put any tech into your deck for it, the matchup becomes significantly easier. So I'm hoping people spend some time actually learning how to play against that deck, because I don't think it's nearly as big of a problem as people think it is. Now, to be fair, it is a problem for some heroes, right? But for a majority, I think they should have not really that many issues with Prism. Next is Victor with 13, tied the same. Victor adoption rate's been huge. He's kind of the gatekeeper of this, of the rest of the decks now, in my opinion. He keeps a lot of the unplayed decks from being able to be played. Kasai at 11, so that's a big step up, not unexpected. Reinar at 8, I think that's a little unexpected. I think Reinar actually ended up winning Fourth Wall Comics, the one that I played on Saturday as well. Kano at 7. I'm pretty sure Prism is keeping Kano down right now, which is pretty much what's happening there. Dory at 6. I would expect this to probably keep dropping. I don't think Dory is very good anymore. I think it's hard to win a tournament on Dory currently, and you should probably just play Kasai if you want to play a Warrior. Versus the Hatchet Dory.
I think that's a little too far. Like, Dory's pretty good still. It's very consistent, very easy to play.
Yeah, it's fine. It's just like...
You will make top cut, but I agree. It's not... It just doesn't spike. Like, you can't just be like, no blocks.
It's super good in Swiss. I agree with you. It's hard to win once you get in top cut.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're talking like Arteans. I think it's like top two decks. ProQuest, I'm done playing Hatchets, I'm pretty sure.
If you have to win the event. If you just have to top four of the event, do Hatchet's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
Then we have Katsu. Unfortunately, Katsu is being held down by Victor right now with 6. Bolton with 6. Teklavossen with 5. He's coming out of the gate. He's starting to be a problem child for some people as well. That's myself in there. Dash at 4. Levy at 4. Riptide at 4. Coming back. And then everyone else at 9. So, anything else in here you think unexpected, expected?
Why is Teklu all of a sudden like very playable and good? I don't understand.
Because Dromai's gone.
Oh, he just destroys
it. It's basically, it's kind of like Tree Frog, right? It's like yep. the same thing. You're just blocking, and you're instead of playing items, you're playing things that block more. So it's like maybe even just better. And as soon as you get to your suit, as long as you chipped a little bit, like the game's over. You discard like 3 cards a turn, and all of your attacks have going. Like if you actually read tech level, Austin, the card's insane. I like kept checking. I was like, oh, I can win if you don't have boost cards. It was like every attack has going. It's like oh.
So yeah, if you look at the winning list here, you would say Teclo versus Azalea. Teclo's okay in that matchup. That's like he can, because of his armor, he can play a very blocky out game quite often in that matchup.
Yep.
Teclo versus Prism should just be Prism favored, unless because Teclo can't run a lot of tech for that matchup, unfortunately. Victor, Teclo's super favored. And by super favored, it's like these are really hard to lose matchups, not just like close. Kasai, Teclo's super favored. Tarentia, super favored. And then the rest of the matchups are a little all over the place. Levy, I think he's okay into. But that's the main thing right there. Also, people aren't familiar with it, and so the people who've been playing it forever, and we have a couple of people like that in our area, are really able to take advantage. I mean, one of the ones in our area beat a Kano.
Yeah, what's the card they're attacking in?
The blue.
What's the item that gives you Arcane Barrier?
Yeah, the blue item that gives you Arcane Barrier. Oh,
they put 3 of those in play and they just AP 6'd.
Yeah.
Rusted Relic.
Yeah.
Yeah, they 3 Rusted Relic.
And then just held 2 Oasises. They collected 2 Oasises and just held them for the rest of the game.
Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to Kate.
Yeah.
Absolutely crushed that event.
So very spicy. Cool. I think we have seen. I don't know. It's been pretty interesting adjustment post Dromai. It really feels like the big deck holding people down right now is Victor, personally.
He's also like not good in this meta, I think.
Yeah, yeah. He's like good enough, especially at a PQ level. But he just has, there's a lot of decks that could like come up and disrupt some of these other decks at the top, but mm-hmm. they're just not allowed to because at least in our area, Victor is very heavily played. Like you're never gonna see a
Tatsu. Zero Victors on Saturday. There's like 10 on Sunday.
Like you're not going to see Katsu do well. It's like one of the reasons like Azalea, there's a ton of Azalea at Retro Lotus, but like they just didn't do very well because the whole, it felt like half the people were playing Victor. They weren't, but it was like, there was a ton of Victor at that event. Okay. Now on to our main topic, which kind of goes with some of the things that we're seeing, but let's talk a little bit about sideboarding. So sideboarding is probably, in my opinion, one of the most underutilized skills in the game currently. It's also one of the areas that you can get most of your advantage in CC is strictly through sideboarding. And this is something that like I don't even think top teams or top players are actually doing properly yet. And it's probably an area that unfortunately for the deck is usually saved for like the last part of the process when you're innovating a deck or making a deck for a tournament. But it's probably where you get most of your edges. I can think of like example, I think straight up on our hatchet list, like our KO sideboard is wrong. It's fine.
It's a plan that works, but it's not the best
plan. It's not the best plan, right? Like, so that's like an example.
It's better than no plan.
It's better than no plan.
Like it's proven, but it's not, there's definitely better.
Yeah. And this game's unique to a sideboard because you don't have to start the game with the same amount of cards as you expect to, because you know we do at the beginning and the normal deck is 60, but you can start with as many cards or all the way down to 60 as you want when you're sideboarding. But I think that is probably one of the big areas for innovation is actually how many cards go in the deck. I know a lot of the time, and this is really lazy, we end up going, I just run like 62 or 63 cards. Like, but that can't be right? Like that has to be in some of those aspects of mistake. But what do you guys think just initially off of sideboarding or how you personally feel about it, sideboarding?
I think you can't like even build a deck until you do your sideboards. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you can have like your core of the deck, but like you can't have a list unless you figure out exactly what you're playing against every single hero. Because like you said, like it's a big part of this game is that you don't play the same cards every game. So it's like a huge benefit. I am like so high on doing as much planning as you can up front because it's just like free value. So I'm always looking to sideboard as soon as possible and figure out what those look like and start tuning there. But I'm with you. I think there's always a lot of work to be done there. Like there's what, like 20 something playable heroes now. Like I doubt most people are really optimizing their sideboard plan for each of those with testing. Like surely you're saying like, oh, Tekla's not real. We'll just play 70 cards and see what happens, right?
Into kind of like aggro sideboarding and then control deck sideboarding. And then they kind of have those configurations and then something will pop up in the middle and they try to figure out on the fly. I guess like Illusionist kind of fits in there now. But I think that you kind of, when I first build a deck, I think about the spectrum of the decks. And then as I play my first 10, 20 games, whatever, you run into stuff and you're like, oh, I need a better config for this. But I do think one thing that's interesting to think about with sideboarding is there's obviously the transformational sideboards as a dash player. That's our main thing. We have two different decks and you can sideboard into one or the other basically. Or there's like, and this is comes from my Magic background, like a lot of Magic sideboarding was just like sideboarding better answers for what your opponent was doing. It was just like switching your removal spells or switching your answer cards. And in Fab, that a lot of that's like, I mean, obviously it's like Oasis Respite against Kano, right? It's a very obvious, but like that is just a different Doom Blade in your sideboard that you can use to optimize how you can interact with your opponent. And there's a lot of, you can gain a lot there by doing one ofs or finding the exact mix that covers like a bunch of matchups, or you can just like pick the ones you think are perfect, right? Like just I could play, like let's say I'm playing Guardian, I could play Staunch or Oasis Respite, but I want three Oasis Respites because I'm gonna make the call that Kano's more popular. So you have all these done in different ways you can build your suite of answers, but what it does though is it makes your deck only be able to do the one thing. Like you're going to just be efficient attacks and then some answers. And you don't have the ability to like fully switch from one plan to another. And I think that a lot of decks kind of fall into one of those two things.
Yeah, I agree. I think when I approach building a deck, I like the thing you said about Dan, that you can't really have a deck unless you have a sideboard ready. When I start looking to build a deck, I'm usually trying to target like three or so decks. Like I'm like, hey, I want this deck to beat these decks. And that's usually where I start from. And then after that, it's about adding additional stuff that might tweak other matchups. But you should have like a core idea of what your deck wants to hit. And for example, and we use this a lot, but the Hatchet one, we wanted to hit, you know, Dromai, KO, and Kano. For instance, like not necessarily beat them, we wanted to be able to play against these decks, right? And so like if you look at the sideboard for the Hatchet deck, it has like the aggressive plan, the aggressive defensive plan to play into KO. It has a completely different weapon and board to play into Dromai, and then it has all of the possible null rune that you could want, as well as Oasis to play into Kano. And so like that was the idea, is like we want a deck that can play into all three of these decks, and that was where that, you know, is born from. And it's very similar when I'm working with other decks, is like I want to find a combination of cards that first beats our target deck, and then after that I start refining down. The part that I think a lot of people miss is going back through the sideboard and going and looking at every configuration of how you're going to play the deck into each deck and then seeing what's missing. Because quite often you'll be like, oh, what's our configuration here? Oh, we put these cards in, we take these cards out. And then you look at it and go, oh man, I'm not running enough blues. Or I have way too many like of these type of attacks. I need another go again to balance this out. And it's important to put it in the configuration you would have it to play against that match and then make sure the deck is still balanced. Like an example of this is when I played in Indy and I was playing Chain. I had a very specific sideboard set up when I played into Starvo, and it hedged both directions. It was hedging if they're going to fatigue me or play aggro. And so I ran, it was like a 66 card deck. And as I put it into that configuration, I looked and said, oh, my blue count is off. And so there's just one random blue, and people ask me about it all the time. There's just a random blue attack that no one ever plays, just sitting in there. I was like, I need it to not be blood debt. I need it to sometimes be playable, but it has to be a blue block three. And so it's just like in the sideboard, it only comes in that configuration, right? And like, that's like a level of the next level after you have your game plans that I think people are missing is like looking at the actual configuration of the deck and then seeing, making sure all your ratios are right. It's like also really important, like Viscerai. Viscerai has to do that. They have to look at every configuration and make sure that like all of their numbers of every type of a card that they have still equals out, which is why sometimes it's hard to decipher what like a Viscerai deck looks like pre or post board.
Yeah, it's like really not the time to get lazy. Like you want to put in the work on your sideboards. Like even if you're updating last minute, make sure you go through every single matchup and make sure your configuration still makes sense. I think it's a great point. And like every deck is really just created for like one event. So like Cody's saying, you want to be starting with a goal for the deck. Like what do you want to be beating, and then figure out the rest from there. I think one sideboarding skill we haven't touched on yet is like knowing when to deviate from what you planned. So this weekend I was playing KO. It's my first tournament on it, so I'm just reading Noah's paper of what he tells me to sideboard, and most of it was incredible. Thank you, Noah. It helped a lot. But he hadn't really tested Teclo much, because why would you? And like I played the original sideboard, it was like 64 cards or something, in case it goes to like fatigue, I guess, I don't know. But basically after the game I was like, wait a second, two Teclos are now undefeated, I'm gonna play them again. Let me think about this. And I was like, no, I don't think this sideboard's correct. I should be playing it like it's pitch that Kano and playing 60 cards and just all out aggression, because it's a race, right? You have to, they're a combo deck. So just being able to like recognize either like if your original plan was wrong, or if the way the decks you're playing against, you expected them to sideboard, they're sideboarding differently. You need to be able to kind of like pivot off of that, especially like between Swiss and top eight, is a huge benefit. And pretty hard to do correctly.
Yeah. I do think that we shouldn't be lazy. It's another focus I want to make moving forward for the next cycle. Not being lazy and just running 61 or 62 cards. Like, I really want to narrow that down, because we have definitely done that a lot, especially with like hatchets and stuff. And it's just like, if the card is worth siding in, there has to be a reason why you need to side something else out. And like, you should just find the thing to side out. And that's the hardest part, because unlike other card games where you're like, this card just isn't good in this matchup, that happens a lot less in this game, because for the most part, all of your cards are adding to a game plan of what your deck is doing. So they're usually like engine cards or payoff cards or, you know, resources. And so like cutting one of the engine stuff to put in like a tech card, for instance, is like KO. When we wanted to put two shunts in, it was like, what do we cut for two shunts? And it's just like, I don't know. Like, we don't want to cut Blade Flurry, right? We don't want to cut, you know, there's like none of this stuff we want to cut, right? And, but we want the two shunts in. So it's like, there has to be a reason to put the two shunts in. We know that. So that has to be better than two of the cards that are in the deck, right? Like, it has to be. And so I think trying to figure that out is definitely worth spending the time on. Because just running 62 cards has to have some percentage of losing you matchups. It has to have some like some negative EV, right?
Yeah, but there's also some positive, right?
A little bit.
Like sometimes those games do go to like deck size. It's like pretty rare though.
It's pretty rare in Decay. I think we had it only happen at the beginning of testing, and it kind of just stuck with us forever. Towards the end of testing, that like never happened.
Agreed. And we really convinced ourselves that we were spacing out the tunic tax. Or the strain on the tunic, right, by adding more cards.
Yeah.
So it's more likely we have more space between the one costs. Which, like, yeah, that's definitely partially true, but maybe we just play a resource curve that doesn't require us to play more than 60 cards instead, right?
Yeah. Opium. We're like, if we need to be able to have our tunic up when we are have it spaced out so I draw it on the right time. I'm a big advocate of, I call it 1-2 trim a few. I think that it lets you put the answer cards in your deck, like in the hatchet deck. I could see wanting to cut like one yellow hit and run. It's like your worst go again enabler. It's the most redundant piece you have, and it lets you get more answers into your deck, and it doesn't like super drastically change your ratios in a negative way. It looks weird. Like when you show people, you're like, oh, I'm cutting one hit and run for this matchup, one Spoils of War, and just one of this other thing, and it's like, no, I want my ratios to be like pretty much the same, but I need two more D-reacts or whatever. I need those like specific answers, and I think that that's something that's a little bit underexplored.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when we were going back through it the other day and I was playing this K, I was like, hey, it was like after Pro Tour, I like just put a message in our Discord. I was like, hey, here's how you sideboard for this matchup now.
We kind of dropped the ball with KO specifically.
It was like, why?
We're like, yeah, it's the best deck. We got to be ready for it. But we didn't really test it that much.
And we just got away with it because people weren't familiar enough with hatchets, right?
Yeah, I was like, this is good enough. Ship it.
Good enough, ship it. Which is not how it should work for Pro Tours, right?
No. Everything else, I think we did really well. But KO specifically, I don't know why we just collectively. It was because like we had to figure out other matchups where KO, like, it was pretty face up. Like, it's kind of back and forth rally game.
But, you know, back to sideboarding, I think it's also important to recognize how big of a deal putting one card in dramatically changes the matchup, and then just, like, committing to doing that. For instance, if you're a Victor player and Time Skippers is not in your sideboard, you need to put it in your sideboard. It's one card. It's, like, literally one card, and you probably already have two hammers in your list. But if you don't have two of the small hammers, then you put another small hammer in. Now it's two cards so that you could actually beat Prism, like reliably beat Prism. That's a big deal, right? Like, there's no reason not to put those two cards in your deck. And like, so sometimes it's just like, it, even if it's like off your game plan, you need to recognize that, like, even if I might only play against one of these decks, if a couple of cards in your sideboard dramatically increases your win rate into a certain deck, like, it's just worth finding the space. Even if you have to trim something, like, we trimmed a helmet in hatchets, like, we're just not running Crown of Providence, which, you know, we're just like, we'll just run balance into everyone because this extra card slot is more important to be put into Kano, right? For instance. And so I think doing that, being disciplined in your sideboard to do that, is a super big help. Cool.
Do you guys think about sideboarding differently for first or second? I feel like that's a really unexplored space. Yeah,
that's a good point.
Yeah, I agree. I think especially in sub matchups like Levia, we had a first and second idea going. If I was going second, since I get to be aggressive first, we just ran less D-reacts and more of our aggressive cards. And if we had to go first, because that means they get the first push turn, then we're just going to put more defensive cards in. To be able to, like, fatigue a little better if that situation comes up.
Yeah, Noah had specific notes for me for going first versus second in some matchups. I won't spill them here, though.
It's Noah's.
That's his game plans, not mine.
Yeah. And we've done that in the past, too, with lots of decks. It's not, like, every matchup first and second isn't different. Oh, yeah. I mean, Viscerai is a big one of this. Like, Viscerai's first and second against every deck is completely different. Because, like, if you're going first, you put more Read the Runes in. If you're not, you take more Read the Runes out. And so, like, He's like a good opening your eyes if you start playing that deck to, like, oh man, there's actually a pretty big difference between going first and second in some decks, and how can maybe you apply that to other decks to just make that even better, right?
Yeah, I think in the aggro mirrors especially, it's a little bit understated. Because, like, when the game's only 4 or 5 turns, it's like, if you can find a little bit of a card that helps you catch up a little bit in that spot, and maybe on the play it's not good, it's like, I think that's a really important spot to try to get some equity.
Yep. And, like, and all this stuff adds up. Like, yeah, in that one game that you play, it might not matter. But, like, if you start taking the sideboard a little bit more seriously, a little bit more planned out, then, like, that's a percentage that you gain in every match you play moving forward. Right. And it's like, who knows what would have been different if I had ran 60 cards in my KO match on stream at Pro Tour instead of 62. Right. Like, we don't know. And all of these things can make a pretty big difference over the long haul of your career. And I think it's like, people need to take it a little bit more seriously, including ourselves, like, on really how important it is. Cause in my opinion, a very big deal. And it's like a little underexplored or talked about on, like, how big of a deal your cyborg game plan is and not being lazy with it.
You know, it's like everything. Doing the work absolutely pays off. Do the work.
Yep. And you just feel more confident. Like, nothing's worse than sitting down and being like, what do I cut? What am I playing? Is this even right?
It's like a huge, yep. Reduces a lot of mental strain. Because, like, you front loaded all the thinking. You can just chip it. Maybe give a little thought to, like, did anything change from what I've saw throughout the day, but huge benefit.
Yep. Okay. Anything else on some, you know, general sideboarding before we move on to pod questions? questions? Nope. Nope. Okay, cool. Okay, let's get into podcast questions. These questions are asked from our premium members in our Discord. If you would like to join the Discord, there'll be a link below. First question coming from Selenor. It says, will you guys be updating the deck list to a post-Dromai state? Or are we just waiting on that? So, are we going to update the Hatchet deck for post-Dromai?
So, I already updated my Hatchet deck because I played it this weekend. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to share it until it was, like, more tested. I'll probably share whatever I end up with at the end of the season regardless. Maybe if I am done with Hatchets, I'll just post what I have now. Yeah, I didn't get to fully test all of it, but I was happy with where I ended up. I'm playing like two shunts instead of three, like we said, so I can play 60 cards instead of 62 to support the third shunt. I basically just kept the same build and cut all the obvious drill my cards. I tried playing some like fancy blues that block two and do things, but it's just like, no, I only want three blocks in this deck.
Yeah.
It's like the whole purpose, to be modular. But otherwise, it's just I'm playing more attack reactions to get the third swing more so I can kind of push the pedal when I need to.
But yeah, I think it would be fine to release it for the people in the Discord, just knowing that it wouldn't be necessarily the same quality as the previous list, as we are not 100% sure what it should look like post-Dromai, but we have kind of our own ideas, and I wouldn't mind putting that up if people in the Discord really want it.
They're good. Yeah. We might do a video after Nats or leading up to Nats, I don't know. Probably not, though, because we don't really, as we said, believe in it being a tournament-winning deck. It's actually pretty good for Nats, though, I think, because it's the whole only four rounds of CC day one, four rounds day two. It'll probably get you to top eight. I wouldn't love my chances in top eight. It's kind of like it's on your hands, right? It's like, I have this deck that's going to do this many numbers a turn. If my opponent plays great and draws good well, I probably lose. But if they don't, I win. So it's like kind of weird.
Yeah, we'll have to see how the new heroes shape anything to see if maybe Dory sneaks in that way. Okay, next question from Rinzo says, would you rather play a meta hero with 50 reps or a B-tier hero with 300 reps?
Depends on the gap.
Depends on the gap. Because B is not really that low.
No, and 50 is more than enough reps, I think, for me to like just lock it in. If it was like 10 or less, I'm playing the B. Yes. Every time. Yeah. Unless the gap is like insane.
50 is, like is chain more versus than enough for me.
Katsu back then.
Yeah.
Agreed.
You might be able to get me for 10 games and a sideboard guide. Sign me up. I'm in. A sideboard guide is really all I need to play a deck. If you give me the notes ahead of time, I'll submit anything.
Okay.
No, 10's too few for me. I'll take the 300 reps all day. I'll play Tekla Vossen. Yeah, if that's what I have the reps on.
Yeah, 10 isn't enough for me either. Like I would take the, even if it was like 10 versus 100, right? I'm going to take 100 on Riptide over 10 on KO. Personally, is how I would take it. But I'll take 50 on KO over 300 on Riptide. Currently, yeah. Right.
50 is like close to the break point, I think. Mm-hmm. Like more than 30.
But if you need way more than 50, and you should be honest with yourself on how many games you need to be comfortable on the deck going in, then maybe it is better to bring the thing that has 300 reps, right? Assuming that it has the ability to play the game still. Good question. Next from Madifs says, when adjusting for short period metas, like the one that we're in right now, what are some considerations that you make? Do you try and spike with an unexpected deck or build, or just iterate on solid heroes for the pro quest?
I think both are good. Mm-hmm. I think if you have a deck you have a ton of reps on, you should probably just keep playing that and let other people adjust and play a little worse than you. But also if you had some crazy brew that no one's ready for that Dromai was shutting down, bring it out, see how you do.
I mean, we ran into this issue. Like you and I have brought, every time we bring hatchets, we top eight, right? Like, mm-hmm. Doesn't matter where we go, but we haven't won one with hatchets, right?
Nope.
And so
either like, we got like countered or just steamrolled because decks can do bigger numbers.
Yeah. So like if it depends what your goal is. If you're trying to win, you might have to do something a little different. If you're just trying to top eight, then you can probably just play, you know, something solid that you've been doing. I am in half panic mode to figure out what I'm playing this weekend. Our area is very weird. If I was playing in a different area, I would have way different decks that I'd be considering, but because it's just like Prism, Azalea, Teclo, Victor, is like those are the four most played decks in our area, is just like just weird, right? And there's always going to be a couple of Kanos and a couple other things floating around. So trying to play through that meta has left me scratching my head currently. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just playing KO because I want to wear the deck more.
Yep. Yep. I would say if your meta is like ours, I think the actual smart thing to do is play KO. Like just play the strongest deck if like you feel like people aren't.
Yep.
I think that's like a really good direction to take it. So if everyone's playing KO and like a couple other decks, and like maybe you want to play something that's like good into that, but like if you're in our area, then you just play the KO. Okay. Millen says, I just want to know how my favorite Fab team is doing this ProQuest season. Are you guys having fun not only during the Pro Queue, but testing and brewing? So basically, what are we doing during the season?
Dude, I'm loving the game right now. I'm just so excited to be playing. I was like, before the ProQuest season started, I was like getting ready to play Star Wars and travel for Alpha Clash. And I was like, you know what? No, that's dumb. I want to play Flesh and Blood. I have like all these new decks I'm trying to learn. I've been working on my Mind Palace, working on memorizing pitch stacks. I have Kano next to me so I can play Solitaire and learn how to pitch that Kano. I'm having a great time currently, despite my frustrating times and top cuts. I'm just loving having a tournament to play, or two tournaments every weekend. It's so sick.
I think I've added like 8 different dash tacks to the Team February. I've just been brewing a lot of different styles of it, and trying other stuff too, but mostly just trying to, I really enjoyed playing Azalea. So I played a lot of that deck last week, but I love this time of the year where it's kind of like there's not too much stress, and there's not really, no one's really keeping anything secret. Like everyone's just talking freely about stuff, and there's no big event like right on the horizon, because so much stuff's going to change with Part of the Mistvale, that it's kind of a good spot just to go play really good games against people who have a lot of games in their deck and just see how you stack up.
Yeah, I would say most of us are playing pretty casually right now, which is our casual is two tournaments every weekend and then playing games like almost every day. So like for me, that's pretty casual, but it's not like going super hard.
No, it's been chill.
Yeah, because we know as soon as we get this set, it is all cylinders go, all the hours into the game for nationals, because we have 1 month. So it's kind of like enjoy the ability to, you know, do whatever you want right now, because once we get that new set, it's just like all of your free time, all of your time is committed to trying to figure this out in 1 month, right?
Yeah. I also like hugely value tournament practice, so like I'm getting very valuable practice every weekend. I'm having fun playing and competing, and I'm also trying to get my PT invite because I still don't have it despite having my book and hotel and basically all my activities for the trip are planned, except I need to get invited. So
okay, is there from Sinope, it says, is there a reason in the current format to play Hatchidori over Kasai now that Dromai is gone?
Cody says no, I say yes.
I say there's one reason. You want a better chance at beating Kano. I don't know if it's worth what you give up in some other matchups, personally, but you can beat Kano pretty reliably with hatchets if they try and first cycle you.
Yeah, hatchets. I think the Kano matchup, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think hatchets has, or Dory has a little bit better matchup into Azalea. It's not great, but it's a little bit better than Kasai's, I think.
It's possible.
That's.
I was thinking it's like Teclo too. Just like any of the matchups where you have to like pressure early. I think the main appeal is just easier to play.
It's definitely easier to play. It definitely feels better to play because
Once
you've been swinging a third weapon, going to I can never swing a third weapon is very difficult mentally.
That is the real reason. If you've played Dory before, you're not going to want to play Kasai. But if you haven't played Dory yet, maybe just play Kasai.
Yeah, the second self like weapon swing only being for two, I just get sad every time. Like my weapons are so lonely, they don't have their buddies to pump them.
Agreed. Yeah, I think realistically though, you should probably just be playing Kasai, like a good Kasai build, if you're comfortable on it. A lot of it's close enough that you can just get away with either direction. Also, I don't actually mind hatchets into Kasai. So if your area is full of Kasais and you kind of want the same thing, but you want to have a different version of the mirror, I think playing hatchets is actually pretty strong into the mirror.
Yeah, I do think if Jeremiah didn't exist, we probably would have played Kasai at the Pro Tour.
Yep.
For what it's worth.
Okay, next is from Sam. It says, with Nationals on the horizon and a set release coming, how much is digging into the meta right now helpful? Is it better to maybe take a mental break rather than tear into the meta and then do a complete 180 in a month?
You should do what you need to do. Kind of depends on where you're at, like, mentally. But there's always value, right? Like, learning decks, regardless of what the other decks are at the time, is good value. And I think understanding the current meta is pretty important, especially with Dromai leaving. Like, it is a new meta. I wouldn't, like, stress yourself over, like, grinding too hard. Like Cody said, for us, we're playing pretty casually right now, despite how often we're playing. So I don't know. Just kind of depends on the person, I'd say.
Yeah, there's a lot of value in, I think, learning decks now where you have time, even if they're not you're going to play, but just being able to, in case it gets better in the next set or suddenly has good matchups with the new heroes, then you already have an idea of what the deck can do and where the power and everything is at for that deck, I think is good to do. Or just working on skills that you need. But yeah, I think right now is just a good relaxed time to be able to explore stuff, because if you're trying to go hard for the next set, you're really going to get to a point where you have to be doing stuff versus I can do whatever I want, right?
Agreed. I remember a lot of times in testing where people were saying, like, if I had 2 more weeks to learn this deck and get more reps, I'd play it. And it's like, this is the time to get your 50 Azalea games in, your 50 Prism games in, and really just trying to familiarize yourself, because it is kind of like free time. Like, once the set releases, it's the clock's ticking. Like, Nationals is coming.
Yeah, and for me personally, like, mm-hmm. I'm recognizing that I have less free time than I used to for, like, when the set does drop. So I'm attempting to find a deck I can self-lock for Nationals in terms of CC, so I can just focus on draft, and then if something is, like, so good that I have to play it, I'll move over. But I'm just trying to, like, prep for Nats now. Just, like, update the list for whatever deck I end up on.
Makes sense. Last question here from Clads, and I think I know what he's talking about here. It says, where is the line between getting good, being needed to deal with a hero, and where a hero is actually being a problem or requires bans? So I think we're talking about, and this is one of my locals as well. So he has heard me many a times say, just learn how to play into Prism. So it's
okay.
When is the required level to be good to play into a deck versus how broken the deck is? Mean that you should probably do something to the deck anyway.
Well, it's when you can't counterplay, right? It's when you can't play into the deck. Like Azalea for some matchups or Kano for some heroes, right? That's when it's like, maybe it should be looked at.
We'll definitely agree with this. I mean, I think Prism is completely...
Like Scab Skins.
You're fine.
Where's the counterplay?
Yeah.
Buckling Blow, I guess? I don't know. We don't all have that.
Yeah, Cody tried, but then he rolled his opponents, went into more sixes.
Right. So.
Yep. I think people should just get good and learn how to play against Prism. I don't know. Like, sit down and play the matchup and then, like, just realize that if their first Herald doesn't hit, they can't do anything with their turn. Like, they can't flip a Herald if they're playing the aggro plan. They can't get extra mana from their chest piece because nothing went to their soul. They don't have soul to flip things with. Like, everything is dependent on the first Herald hitting, so make a game plan against playing against Prism when you don't let their first Herald hit, and sometimes you have to pop it, and sometimes you just block it out, and most of the time in the first cycle, you're just going to be blocking it out. And realize that their max damage per turn is typically around or around the amount that your hand can block for, so it's pretty hard for them to push damage if, like, you play the game in a very slow, methodical way against them. And, like, but if you never get reps against Prism, then like it's going to take you infinite hours to figure any of this out and get comfortable doing it, right? So like, just sit down and play Prism games. I think that's it. I mean, but then again, I've been on record saying I think the original Prism was not even broken in almost no iterations of the game. Was original Prism really an issue because it couldn't beat almost any aggro deck in the game? It only beat aggro players who didn't know what they're doing. So like, but it's like a very similar thing to how Prism feels now to me. Like this happened to me at Pro Tour. The only reason I got ninth at Pro Tour is like in day one, my Briar opponent just like left one of my auras up. He just like he was clearing, and then I played a blue aura and he just went like, I go face now. And I was just like, I won the game. Like you did everything right until this one spot. Why did you do this? And then I just took over the game from that one aura. And it was just like, but I should have lost. And if the aggro player just played the game plan every time into Prism, like Prism doesn't win like half of the events that they played into. It's just like just player issue for a lot of that.
I agree.
I mean, how many times did I beat you when you were playing Fi as Prism?
Like actual zero, maybe one.
Actually zero. Because you just...
Well, Fi was so easy. I mean, I guess, yeah, if you don't know what to do. But Fi was so easy because like it's one of your five attacks for the turn that clears an aura instead of like the only attack, right?
Yep.
But still, just kill the auras. I don't know.
Just kill auras. I'm with you. Yeah.
Easy testing that it's illusionist. Don't do math. Just kill their stuff. And yes. I was like, oh, okay. This makes a lot more sense now.
Yes. Just don't care about your math of your attack. Just kill their stuff.
Yeah, it's more like understand their math, like Cody said. Mm-hmm. Like if you take a turn killing their stuff, worst case, they're going to attack you for 12. Oh, no.
Okay. Well,
or they'll play more stuff and then just kill that stuff.
Yep.
Right.
If they play more stuff, you kill more stuff. You know what happens with Prism? Unlike other top decks, they get really bad hands, like a lot of the time, where they can't even throw two heralds at you. Like you can legitimately just like give them your whole hand for like a large portion of the game, and eventually they'll just like attack you once. You give them your hand, and they'll be like, pass, and like you'll just be like, you're like, okay, like now you can throw stuff. That used to be a strat that we were running, it with Kasai. It was just like block until popper, pop, and then hit them some more. And like, cause you get the extra card. You're like actually playing like a block deck, but you have a popper and the popper buys you an extra card in your hand so then you can push and you've taken no damage and they've gone through a bunch of heralds. Like there's a bunch of these different like ways to approach the matchup. It's just like people need to spend some time really looking at what the deck can do and then all of its failure points and then trying to make good decisions and get reps. Or play the deck yourself and then watch your opponent just block you and you'd be like, what do I do? Okay, I think that is enough of our Prism rant. I think we're going to go. I'm going to go beat up some Prisms because that's what I love to do. So goodbye, everyone. See ya.
Yeah, we're getting rid of the envelope. Seven here, but,
envelope. What we could do here darkness. Is go ahead and play the envelope.
All three pitches of envelope and darkness.